You are, well, you're basically a walking, talking mathematical miracle.
Yeah, that is a pretty good way to put it.
Right. I mean, I really want you, the listener, to just stop and think about that for a second. Every single time you blink or take a breath or, you know, just process the sound of my voice right now, you are operating this incredibly complex piece of machinery that somehow, against all odds, built itself.
Built itself out of literally nothing but dead rocks and weather.
Exactly. 4 billion years ago, there was nothing on this planet, just rocks, some chaotic storms, and this thin, lifeless soup of chemicals. And then somehow that dead chemistry crossed this invisible threshold and just decided to become alive.
It is the ultimate cold case mystery, honestly.
So today we're going to look at the exact chemical grammar that made that happen. We're going on a deep dive into how you and I even exist.
And to do that, we are looking at this brilliant piece of synthesis. It's a paper called The Grammar of Emergence by C.F. Dietz. It's from the 2026 series Consciousness, Closure, and the Cosmos.
It's a heavy title, but the content is just mind-blowing.
It really is. What Dietz is doing is taking the foundational evolutionary biology of Stuart Kaufman, who is this legendary complexity scientist, and Dietz is stretching Kaufman's theories all the way from those primordial puddles to the actual structure of human consciousness.
Okay, let's unpack this. Mm-hmm. Our mission for this deep dive is to basically map that bridge, right? We're going to start right in the chaos of the early Earth, try to figure out how a bunch of molecules accidentally taught themselves to survive. And by the end of this, we'll see why that exact same ancient survival mechanism is currently operating in your brain right now.
Yeah, and to really understand the solution, we first have to understand how insanely hostile that starting environment actually was.
Set the scene for us. 4 billion years ago.
Right. So if we rewind 4 billion years, the surface of the Earth is what physicists would call thermodynamically rich.
Which means what exactly? Just hot.
Hot, violent, and relentless. We are talking about a relentless bombardment of energy. You have harsh solar radiation stripping the atmosphere because there's no ozone layer yet. You have massive volcanic activity everywhere.
Oh, right. And those hydrothermal vents in the oceans, too.
Exactly. At the bottom of these highly acidic oceans, you have vents spewing out superheated minerals. Plus, on top of all that, continuous, violent lightning storms.
So it's an environment that basically wants to tear things apart, not build them up. Because, I mean, thermodynamics is driven by entropy, right?
Yes, exactly.
The tendency of organized things to just break down into chaotic heat.
The second law of thermodynamics is basically a death sentence for any kind of organization.
Mm-hmm.
But, and this is the crucial part, alongside all that chaotic energy, you also have extreme molecular diversity.
Okay, so a lot of different ingredients in the soup.
Tons of them. The primordial soup was filled with amino acids, simple lipids, nucleotides. And some of this was being forged locally in the heat of those volcanic vents, but a staggering amount of it was literally raining down from space.
Wait, raining down from space? Like from meteorites?
Yeah, delivered by the constant impacts of carbon-rich meteorites. It was just a constant delivery system of complex molecules.
So I'm trying to picture this physically for the listener. You have an ocean full of trillions of these little chemical puzzle pieces, and you have lightning and heat constantly stirring the pot. But the source text uses a very specific phrase here. It says the environment was thermodynamically rich, but organizationally poor.
Right, because there is no blueprint. There's no plan.
Right.
Think of it. Think of a tornado tearing through a junkyard.
Okay, I like this analogy.
The junkyard might contain every single nut, bolt, wire, and piece of glass needed to build a fully functional Ferrari. And the tornado is providing a massive amount of kinetic energy.
But a tornado hitting a pile of parts doesn't spontaneously assemble a highly tuned sports car.
No, of course not. The energy is random. In that primordial soup, there was zero capacity for any group of molecules to draw a boundary and say, you know, this is inside and that is outside.
There was no mechanism to harness the energy, to actually maintain a structure. So how do we get from a chemical junkyard to a biological Ferrari? Because the standard answer, like what I remember from high school biology class, is the RNA world hypothesis.
Right, the classic textbook answer.
Yeah, the idea that before there were cells or DNA or anything, there was just RNA. And one day, a very lucky strand of RNA formed in that chaotic soup and just started copying itself.
And the RNA world hypothesis has been the dominant scientific framework for decades,
right,
mostly because it seems incredibly elegant.
I mean, it does make sense on the surface. DNA stores our genetic info today, and proteins do the physical labor, right? They act as enzymes to catalyze reactions.
Yeah, And RNA sits right in the middle of that process. But back in the 1980s, scientists discovered ribozymes.
Ribozymes?
Yeah, they are strands of RNA that can actually fold themselves up into complex 3D shapes and act as catalysts, just like proteins do.
Oh, wow. So if RNA can store genetic information and act as a catalyst to drive chemical reactions, it sounds like the absolute perfect all-in-one starter kit for life.
It does. It really does.
You just need one RNA molecule to fold up in a way that allows it to catalyze its own replication. Like it grabs loose building blocks from the soup, copies itself, those copies copy themselves, and boom, suddenly life is spreading. It sounds completely logical.
It sounds totally logical, right up until you look at the sheer, staggering physical probability of that actually happening.
Which is what Dietz's paper points out, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
The paper is highly critical of the RNA world. It points out a fundamental physical paradox, basically a chemical chicken and egg problem.
Because template replication, the act of a molecule reading a sequence and building a copy, isn't just two chemicals bumping together in the dark.
Not at all. It is a highly complex mechanical factory process.
The text mentions that a strand of RNA capable of acting as a replication engine would have to be incredibly long and have a highly specific sequence. Like, it's not a simple molecule.
It's massive by chemical standards. And here's the fatal flaw: water is terrible for long chemical chains.
Really? But life started in the water.
I know, it's ironic. But water naturally causes hydrolysis. It actively breaks those long chains apart. So to build a long, complex RNA replication engine, you need an environment that already has mechanisms to protect it and build it up faster than the water can break it down.
Oh, I see. You require the very machinery that the replication is supposed to produce in the first place.
Exactly. You need the factory to build the factory.
Wow. So the RNA world hypothesis doesn't actually solve the origin of life at all. It just relies on a massive statistical miracle.
Right.
It essentially asks us to believe that the ultimate 3D printer randomly assembled itself in a tornado out of pieces that were actively dissolving and then immediately started printing copies of itself.
Yeah. It forces a single molecule to bear the entire burden of life's origin. And this is exactly where Stuart Kaufman completely flips the board.
Kaufman being the complexity scientist we mentioned earlier.
Right. Kaufman, who operated out of the Santa Fe Institute, realized that looking for a single magical molecule is a fool's errand. Life cannot be a solitary event.
The text has a great quote here. Let me find it here. The first closure was not a molecule. It was a grammar.
A grammar. That is such a profound way to phrase it.
Meaning a system of relationships. Kaufman is saying life didn't start with one molecule copying itself. It started with a network of molecules interacting with each other.
Which brings us to his first major claim, right? Hmm. The concept of a collectively autocatalytic set.
Yes, and to really grasp this, we need to look closely at what a catalyst physically does. Because it's not magic.
Let's break it down for the listener.
Okay, so in that primordial soup, let's say molecule A and molecule B might have the chemical potential to bond and form a new molecule, molecule C.
Okay, A plus B equals C.
But they're just floating around blindly in this massive ocean. They might drift past each other for 10,000 years before they accidentally collide at the precise angle and with the exact right amount of speed to actually bond.
They need to overcome an energy barrier. Exactly, the activation energy. So a catalyst is a third molecule that enters the picture. It has a specific physical shape that acts like a lock for A and B.
Kind of like a physical template.
Yeah, it literally grabs A, it grabs B, it forces them into the correct alignment and snaps them together to release C almost instantly.
And then what happens to the catalyst?
It lets go, completely unchanged, and it's ready to grab the next pair. It speeds up the reaction by millions of times.
Okay, so an autocatalytic set is a network of these molecules generated from a basic food set in the environment. And the absolute crux of Kaufman's theory, the thing that replaces that miraculous single RNA molecule, is that no single molecule in this network catalyzes its own formation.
Right. None of them are self-replicating. Molecule one cannot build molecule one.
But molecule one happens to be the perfect shape to catalyze the formation of molecule two.
Yes. And molecule two catalyzes molecule three. Molecule three catalyzes molecule four. And the loop closes when molecule four catalyzes the formation of molecule one.
I was trying to think of an analogy for this, and it's like a hyper-efficient, maybe slightly desperate survival community.
Oh, I like that. Run with that.
Okay. Imagine a potluck or a village where literally nobody knows how to cook a full meal or build a whole house, right? No one person has the skills to build a house, grow food, make clothes, and forge tools.
They'd all die on their own.
Exactly. Say, person A only knows how to forge iron. If you leave them alone, they starve. But but they forge an incredible plow for person B.
Who only knows how to farm.
Right. Person B only knows how to farm, so they use the plow to grow a massive crop. They give the extra food to person C, who only knows how to build shelters. And person C uses that energy to build a blacksmith forge for person A.
None of them can survive alone, but collectively the network feeds, shelters, and supplies itself.
The catalysis here is the tool building. Person A builds the tool that lowers the barrier of difficulty for person B.
That is a brilliant way to explain it. The physical implications of this in chemistry are just astounding.
And Kaufman didn't just hypothesize it, by the way.
Well,
yeah. Mathematicians Mike Steele and Wim Hordijk actually formalized this into what is called the RAF framework. They proved mathematically that in any sufficiently complex chemical system, these networks don't just happen by miracle. They arise almost inevitably.
Wait, inevitably?
Yeah. As the diversity of molecules in the soup increases, the mathematical probability that one molecule will happen to act as a catalyst for another molecule approaches absolute certainty.
So the more crowded the junkyard gets, the more likely the parts accidentally start hooking up in useful ways.
Precisely. And when the density of these catalytic connections hits a critical threshold, the system undergoes a sudden transformation. In physics, this is called a first-order phase transition.
Meaning it's not gradual. The emergence of the network isn't a slow millions of years crawl. Yeah. It happens abruptly.
Completely abruptly.
The text compares this to water freezing, right?
Yes.
Which makes so much sense. Like, when you put water in the freezer, it doesn't slowly get slushier and slushier as the temperature drops.
Right. The water molecules stay liquid and chaotic as they cool down.
Until they hit exactly 0 degrees, and then snap, the molecules instantly lock into a crystalline grid. It goes from chaos to structure in a moment.
Apply that exact same logic to our chemical soup. For millions of years, you have random molecules sputtering along, occasionally forming something, usually breaking apart.
It's just a mess.
But the moment the catalytic links close that loop, when molecule 4 finally catalyzes molecule 1, the entire set snaps into a self-sustaining cycle.
And suddenly, the concentration of these specific molecules spikes.
Yes. They dominate their local environment because they are building each other faster than the chaotic environment can break them down. One moment, it is dead chemistry. The next moment, it is a functioning network.
Which solves the chicken and egg problem beautifully. We have our network. The village is working together.
And the grammar.
Right. But, okay, here's where my brain gets stuck. The primordial Earth is still a violent place. A network of loose chemicals just floating in the ocean can easily be washed away by a tide or cooked by a volcanic vent. Mm. How does this invisible mathematical network actually gain a physical identity? How does it build a wall?
This is where we move to Kaufman's second concept. And structurally, this is the most crucial one. It's called constraint closure.
Constraint closure. Okay, break that down for us.
If the autocatalytic network explains how life sustains itself, constraint closure explains how it separates itself from the rest of the universe.
Let's try to ground this in physical reality, because the paper admits this part gets highly theoretical. The text talks about boundary conditions or constraints governing thermodynamic processes.
Let's think about a physical constraint you'd interact with every day. A cylinder in a car engine is a constraint.
Okay.
If you ignite a drop of gasoline in the open air, the explosion just expands equally in a sphere. That is unconstrained thermodynamic energy. It just dissipates as random heat.
Right. It doesn't do any useful work.
But if you put that exact same drop of gasoline inside a thick metal cylinder with a piston at the bottom, the rigid walls of the cylinder constrain the explosion. The energy has nowhere to go but down, pushing the piston.
The constraint forces the chaotic energy to do useful directional work.
Exactly. So in our chemical network, the constraints aren't metal walls. They are physical and chemical properties.
Like what?
Well, maybe it's a localized temperature gradient, or more likely, it's a layer of lipid molecules, fats, that naturally bunch together in water to form a little bubble or a vesicle.
Ah, right. Oil and water don't mix, so the fats form a little sphere. That lipid bubble is a perfect example of a constraint. It traps certain chemicals inside and keeps others outside.
Yes, and by trapping them in a tiny enclosed space, it massively increases their concentration, forcing those catalytic processes to happen so much faster.
But here's where it gets really interesting and honestly kind of mind-bending. The text states that the release of energy through those constrained chemical processes goes on to construct the exact same constraints.
This is the definition of biological identity. The processes construct the constraints that govern the processes.
Wait, so if we go back to the car engine analogy, that would be like the explosion of the gasoline physically forging the metal cylinder that contains the next explosion?
Exactly.
A machine that builds the exact factory required to build the machine.
Which a normal mechanical car engine obviously cannot do. A mechanical engine just degrades over time. It rusts, it breaks. But in constraint closure, the system is fundamentally self-referential.
Okay, let's look at the lipid bubble again then. How does that work in the bubble?
So, the lipid boundary traps the autocatalytic chemical network inside. The network processes energy and building blocks from whatever leaks in. And what does that network produce? More lipids.
Oh, and those new lipids get pushed to the boundary.
Yes, they naturally integrate into the membrane, repairing and expanding the bubble. The boundary makes the internal reactions possible, and the internal reactions literally construct the boundary.
Dietz emphasizes a vital quote here from the text. It says, cells literally construct specifically themselves. It is not just any random boundary. It is the identical organizational structure reconstructing itself continuously.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
It completely redefines what it means to be alive.
Yeah.
Like if you look at a rock, it just is what it is. If you chip a piece off, just a smaller rock.
No.
But a living thing is a process of constant self-reconstruction. I mean, think about human biology.
Our cells are constantly dying and being replaced.
Right. The physical carbon, nitrogen, and water making up your brain right now listening to this is completely different material than what was in your head a decade ago.
You are, on a molecular level, a completely different collection of atoms.
So why am I still me?
Yeah.
Why do I have the same memories, the same personality?
Because your constraint closure remained intact.
The physical matter flows through you like water through a whirlpool.
That's a perfect image. The water is constantly changing, but the shape of the whirlpool remains the same because of the constraints of the riverbed and the current. Your organizational identity, the specific set of constraints that defines your biological and neural architecture, has been pulling in new matter from your environment, from the food you eat, and forcing it to conform to the shape of you.
That self-referential closure is the exact property that divides the living from the dead. It's not the stuff you're made of, it's the pattern of the constraints.
Exactly.
Okay, so we have a network, and it has built a physical boundary. We have an identity. But if this primitive chemical loop just sits in its little bubble, doing the exact same reactions forever, it's never going to evolve.
Right, it would just be a static loop.
It won't become a dinosaur or a pine tree or us. How does it learn new tricks? How does it actually grow?
To understand growth, Kaufman introduces a concept that dictates the evolution of the entire universe, honestly. It's called the adjacent possible.
The adjacent possible. Mm-hmm. The text defines this as the bounded space of what can next come into existence, given what currently exists.
It is entirely governed by path dependency.
Path dependency.
Yeah, meaning you cannot skip steps in chemistry, just like you cannot skip steps in technological evolution. Let's look at human history for a moment to make the abstract chemistry a bit more concrete.
Okay, let's do it.
Think about the smartphone, the iPhone, the raw physical materials required to build a microchip and a touchscreen, the silicon, the gold, the rare earth metals, the glass. They were all present on Earth during the Roman Empire.
Right. The atoms haven't changed.
Exactly. There was no physical law preventing an iPhone from existing in the year 100 AD.
But a Roman blacksmith couldn't just hammer one out on an anvil.
Because the iPhone was not in the adjacent possible of the Roman Empire. The adjacent possible is strictly what is one single step away.
So the Romans had to invent advanced metallurgy first.
Which centuries later opened the door to understanding electricity, which opened the door to the telegraph, then vacuum tubes, then transistors, then microchips. You can only access the next ring of possibility from where you currently stand.
It's like the ultimate video game skill tree.
Oh, yeah, exactly like that.
If you start a new character at level 1, the game mathematically prevents you from equipping the legendary fire sword. It's grayed out. You have to spend hours unlocking the basic wooden sword, then learning to mine iron, then smelting an iron sword, then discovering basic fire magic. Each new skill you acquire becomes a tool that unlocks the next tier.
That is the adjacent possible in a nutshell.
Or think about language. A toddler doesn't just wake up one day and write a sonnet in French. They learn the word for apple and more. But every time they learn a new word, They don't just add one thing to their brain. They exponentially expand the combinatorial possibilities of their sentences.
Yes.
A new word unlocks an entirely new adjacent possible of thoughts they can suddenly express.
And this is exactly how Kaufman's early chemical networks evolved. So picture that primitive lipid bubble we talked about floating in the ocean. Suppose an entirely new molecule, maybe a strange peptide delivered by a meteorite, bumps into the boundary and gets pulled inside.
Okay, new ingredient enters the potluck.
If the network can incorporate that new molecule, if it can use it as a new catalyst or a new constraint, it takes one step into its adjacent possible.
And the moment it takes that step, the map changes.
The map expands instantly. By adding that one new peptide, suddenly there are maybe 50 new chemical reactions that were completely impossible a millisecond ago, but are now mathematically reachable. The horizon of the adjacent possible is pushed outward.
The paper uses a phrase here that I just love, structured openness. I find that incredibly beautiful.
It really is. What's fascinating here is how it frames the universe.
The universe isn't just a chaotic free-for-all where anything can happen at any time. It has strict logical structure. You have to follow the path.
But because every single step opens up multiple new paths, the universe is endlessly generative. It can never run out of novel things to create.
It replaces a static, deterministic universe with one that is actively exploring its own potential. But, as Dietz's paper points out, to get from a chemical bubble exploring its potential to a true biological cell, we need one more foundational piece from Kaufman.
We need to understand how these expanding networks actually stack on top of each other.
Which brings us to the fourth concept, Kantian holes. And I have to admit, seeing the name Immanuel Kant, an 18th century German philosopher, pop up in a paper about primordial microbiology threw me for a loop.
It seems completely out of place until you look at what Kant was obsessing over in his Critique of Judgment.
What was he looking at?
Kant was looking at the natural world and realizing that the physics of his time, the Newtonian physics of gears and gravity and billiard balls, it could easily explain how a star forms or how a rock falls, but it completely failed to explain a single blade of grass.
Because a machine operates fundamentally differently than an organism.
Precisely. If you look at a pocket watch, it is a complex whole made of parts. The gears turn the hands, the spring drives the gears. But the gear does not build the spring.
Right.
If a gear breaks, the watch stops, but it doesn't dissolve. The parts don't maintain each other.
Kant defined a natural purpose, what we now call a Kantian whole, as a system where the parts exist for the sake of the whole, and the whole exists by means of the parts.
Yes. In a living organism, the parts actively construct and maintain each other. The whole system only survives through the coordinated activity of the parts, and the parts only have their specific physical form and function because of the whole.
Like, remove the heart from a human, the whole system dies. But the heart itself was built by the system's stem cells and blood vessels. The interdependence is absolute.
Kaufman uses this philosophical concept to explain the physical assembly of life through what he calls nesting. The evolutionary process was like assembling Russian nesting dolls.
Okay, walk us through the nesting process.
Kaufman argues that those first primitive small molecule autocatalytic sets we talked about, the ones that form the lipid bubbles, those were first order Kantian holes. These early systems eventually specialized into what we now recognize as basic metabolism.
Basically the way a cell processes raw energy.
Yeah.
So metabolism came first. It was a functioning first order system exploring its adjacent possible. But as it explored, it must have bumped into other systems, right?
Yes, because out there in the primordial ocean, other autocatalytic networks had also formed. Maybe one set was made entirely of peptides. Maybe another set was made of those RNA fragments we talked about earlier. These were their own second order system.
And when they collide?
When the metabolic network collided with an RNA network, they didn't just compete or destroy each other. Because they're exploring their adjacent possibles, they found a way to link their constraint closures together.
The potluck got bigger.
Exactly. The metabolic system provided the energy, and the RNA system provided the stable sequence information.
They merged.
They merged to form a massive, vastly more complex third-order Kantian whole. This third-order whole is the protocell. It is a system of systems.
And that completely flips the script on the RNA world hypothesis. We assumed RNA had to come first and miraculously invent everything else. But Kaufman's nesting model shows that RNA and metabolism evolved in parallel.
Right. They were separate survival networks that figured out how to collaborate and lock their identities together to form a higher order life form.
It is a stunningly elegant solution to the origin of biology. But This is exactly where C.F. Dietz, the author of our source text, steps in and asks the absolute biggest question of the paper.
Yeah, this is where the paper really shifts gears.
Kaufman has successfully mapped the grammar of chemistry. He has shown how dead molecules can form networks, build boundaries, grow into the adjacent possible, and merge into cells. But if we are trying to explain the universe, biology isn't enough.
No, it's not. We have to explain the observer.
Right. We have to explain how we get from a single-celled organism metabolizing sugar to a human being experiencing consciousness, forming cultures, and writing scientific papers.
Dietz argues that Kaufman's biological model leaves a theoretical gap. If you stop at the cell membrane, you haven't explained the mind. So Dietz introduces an overarching theory called the closure framework.
And the core argument here is that the exact same structural logic that built the first cell didn't stop operating. It just scaled up.
Scaled up dramatically. Dietz asserts that Kaufman's concept of constraint closure at the chemical level is just the most foundational example of what Dietz calls a closure regime.
That closure regime.
And a closure regime operates at every level of reality. Dietz defines it as any system that stabilizes some content by drawing distinctions, establishing identity criteria, and maintaining lawful relationships among its internal elements.
If I look at the chemical network, it perfectly fits that definition. The boundary draws a distinction between the chemicals inside the cell and outside the cell. The identity criterion is the unbroken loop of constraints.
Now apply that exact same definition to human cognition. When a human mind forms a belief system or a worldview, it is creating a cognitive closure regime.
Okay, how so?
It draws distinctions, what is true versus what is false. It establishes identity, who am I, in relation to this belief, and it maintains lawful relationships among its concepts.
So Dietz is arguing that a human language, a cultural tradition, and a biological cell are all using the exact same structural grammar to maintain their existence in a chaotic universe.
Yes, they are all closure regimes defending their identities.
And the mechanism that drives them to evolve is what Dietz calls supersession. This part of the paper blew me away. Let's unpack supersession because it connects 4 billion years of history in one straight line.
It's the engine of learning, basically. Dietz says that every closure regime eventually faces a crisis. The environment changes.
For that primitive chemical network, maybe a volcanic vent cools down and its primary molecular food source just vanishes.
When the food source vanishes, the chemical network is in acute danger of breaking. Its identity is threatened. To survive, it has to reach desperately into its adjacent possible, pull in a new molecule, and rewrite its internal constraints to process a new food source.
It abandons its old organizational state and adopts a new one to survive.
Dietz calls this chemical supersession.
And the text explicitly points out that this blind chemical adjustment is the primordial physical root of what eventually becomes human learning.
Think about what happens in your brain when you learn something that fundamentally challenges your worldview. Let's say you hold a strong cognitive belief, a closure regime. You encounter new, anomalous evidence that totally contradicts it.
Your cognitive regime is threatened. You enter a state of crisis, sometimes even physiological stress.
To resolve the crisis, your neural networks literally rewrite their synaptic weights, that is, neural supersession. Your mind abandons the old paradigm, reaches into the unknown, and reorganizes its constraints to incorporate the new truth.
That is cognitive supersession.
Exactly.
It is structurally identical. The chemical blob surviving a temperature drop and me changing my mind when presented with a better argument are the exact same survival mechanism, just operating at different levels of complexity.
Right. Higher level organizations like human cognition aren't magical phenomena superimposed on top of biology. They use the outputs of biological closures as their raw materials.
It is a single unbroken structural arc from the first phase transition to the consciousness of the person listening to this audio. But Dietz adds one more critical concept to this framework, the remainder.
The remainder. Dietz says that every time a closure regime forms, it inevitably generates a remainder. The remainder is everything that lies outside the closure's capacity to understand or incorporate. It is the positive resource of the unknown.
Because no system, no matter how complex, can map the entirety of reality. A biological cell only knows about the specific chemicals its receptors can bind to.
Right. Everything else in the ocean, the radio waves, the distant stars, the philosophical concepts is completely invisible to it. That is its remainder.
For human culture, the remainder is everything we haven't discovered yet. It's the physics we don't have math for, the emotions we don't have words for.
Dietz points out that Kaufman's adjacent possible is just the immediately reachable face of the remainder. It is the shoreline of the unknown.
Every time we learn something, we step onto the shore, pull a piece of the remainder into our known world, and expand.
But we never reach the end, which brings us to the final and most profound section of the paper. Section 7 introduces the concept of M.
Dietz defines M as the inexhaustible ground of reality that lies beyond all adjacent possibles. The core premise here is that the universe is not convergent.
Not convergent, meaning what?
Meaning no matter how many millions of years life evolves, no matter how much science human beings figure out, we will never, ever exhaust M. There is no final state of the universe where all knowledge is known and all possibilities are mapped.
The well is infinitely deep, and it is interpreting what this infinite well actually is that we find the climactic moment of the paper.
The author's note highlights a massive, highly productive disagreement between Stuart Kaufman and C.F. Dietz. And I think it's important to state here for the listener that we're not taking sides on this.
No, definitely not. We're just laying out how these two brilliant minds interpret the same data differently.
It is fascinating to see two monumental thinkers look at the exact same physical and mathematical reality and arrive at two completely different philosophical conclusions. Let's lay out both perspectives clearly because they are both rigorous and profound.
Okay, so both Kaufman and Dietz agree completely on the math. They agree on constraint closure, they agree on the adjacent possible, and they agree that M is inexhaustible.
But Kaufman approaches this strictly as a complexity scientist and a theoretical biologist. When Kaufman looks at that endless well of the unknown, he calls it the ceaseless creativity of the universe.
For Kaufman, the universe is just a naturally, endlessly generative space. It doesn't need to be guided by anything. The laws of physics, chemistry, and complexity naturally produce genuine novelty.
It is a staggeringly beautiful, creative cosmos unfolding on its own. He is saying we don't need to invent a mystical or conscious force to explain why the universe keeps inventing new things. The math of the adjacent possible explains it perfectly.
It is a deeply poetic but fundamentally materialist view. But then we look at Dietz's interpretation through the closure framework.
Right. Dietz looks at that exact same inexhaustible ground of M, that endless capacity for novelty, and argues that you cannot explain consciousness as a late-stage accident of biology.
Dietz argues that M actually possesses the character of primitive, foundational conscious presence. Before there was any organizational structure, before there was a chemical network or a cell, the ground of reality itself had a conscious quality.
Dietz proposes that as physical structures evolved, as the nested Kantian holes built up to human brains, they weren't creating consciousness out of dead matter. They were simply building more complex antennas to tune into the conscious presence that was always there.
Wow. So you have Kaufman, who says the universe is a brilliant, creative, mathematical unfolding, and Dietz, who says the universe is a fundamentally conscious reality manifesting itself through structure.
Is the cosmos a ceaselessly creative math equation, or is there a foundational awareness that gives birth to the math?
The source text does not attempt to declare a winner. It presents this as the bleeding edge of modern philosophy of science. What is so powerful is that neither thinker is dismissing the other's science. They rely on the exact same structural grammar. They just name the infinite unknown differently based on their disciplines.
It is a staggering journey we've been on today. To pull it all together, we started on an early Earth full of chaotic energy and random parts. We saw how a subset of that chemistry crossed a physical threshold, a phase transition, and snapped into a collectively autocatalytic network, a village of molecules helping each other survive.
We saw how that network achieved constraint closure, physically building its own boundaries, creating the very first instance of biological identity.
We followed it as it stepped into the adjacent possible, expanding its abilities, merging with other networks like RNA into nested Kantian holes, and eventually building the protocell.
And then through Dietz's closure framework, we traced that exact same structural grammar of survival and adaptation all the way up through evolutionary history. We saw how chemical supersession eventually became cognitive supersession, leading directly to our ability to think, to learn, and to question our own origins.
There is a quote from Kaufman referenced in the text that has entirely changed how I view my place in the world. He says that because of this unbroken chain of emergence, we are truly at home in the universe. Not because the universe was magically designed just for us, like we are living in some artificial terrarium.
Right.
But because we are physically, structurally made of the exact same organizational logic that has been bootstrapping itself from the chaos for 4 billion years.
The universe spent 4 billion years building a system capable of looking back at itself. We are the grammar of emergence, deepened far enough to finally read the text.
And I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over. Something that takes this massive cosmic theory and brings it right down to your day-to-day life.
Oh, I like where this is going.
If the theory of the adjacent possible dictates that a system can only access the next level of reality based on the exact, specific path it has already walked, then think about your own personal history.
Every choice you've made.
Every book you have ever read. Every terrible mistake you have ever made. Every random conversation you have had with a stranger. It isn't just your past. It is the literal boundary condition, the constraint closure that is actively constructing your future.
It's building your personal adjacent possible.
Your unique past is the exact chemical structure that determines your specific adjacent possible, which means the actions you take today are literally rewriting the mathematical boundaries of what you are capable of tomorrow. So what adjacent possible are your current choices unlocking for you? What new doors are you building right now?
It is the most vital question any conscious system can ask itself.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the sources. Keep expanding your boundaries and stay curious.